This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. First up, an exit interview with Marty Martinez, Boston's top public health official. You know, leading a public health department is an important job, but it used to be pretty low profile. Then 2020 happened. Marty Martinez is Boston's chief of health and human services, has overseen the city's response to an opioid crisis, a global pandemic, a surge in homelessness and addiction. He has served for 4 years under three mayors, but tomorrow he is hanging up those gloves and leaving his post. We wanted to talk with him before he goes, and he joins us now. Marty Martinez, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So last day just ahead, if you could wave a magic wand and make one thing happen before you go. You don't need any process, no cooperation, no negotiations or approval. What would you wave your wand and make happen?
Wow, it's hard. There's, you know, like a classic local government guy, I'd like to use the wand on 10 different things, to be honest with you. I think it would be to really get us past the ongoing sort of twists and turns of COVID. COVID-19 has just so greatly impacted so many people and so many facets of life. And although we've gotten past probably, hopefully, our darkest days from the 2020, we're seeing a surge again, and we're still back in it, and the team's back doing so many of the things it had been doing. So I wish we could get past it and really get to the recovery part, which we know is a lot of work as well. But I wish we could do that.
All right. So I think I know what you're going to say in answer to this, but without a magic wand, what does get us past it and to the recovery phase? What's the single biggest thing?
Yeah, vaccine. I mean, that's the single biggest thing. It's making sure that people who aren't vaccinated get vaccinated, people get their boosters, which is super important, and that we continue what has been, you know, my commitment and the commitment of the city, that we look at it from an equity lens. Who's most inequitably impacted, and making sure that we're getting folks access who need it. That, you know, those, that disproportionate impact is still the case of who's getting boosters and who isn't, and we have to make sure that all residents get vaccinated. So that is the way we get past it. And I know it's tough. And to be frank, I know people are tired. They're ready to move past COVID. But unfortunately, as we live with COVID, the vaccine is really the way to sort of get us to a new place and get us past what is this ongoing sense of urgency we have around trying to fight COVID.
So there's a lot there I want to pick up on, but I'm going to hone in on your word tired for a second, because as I was reading old material and interviews with you, et cetera, getting ready for this conversation, I found myself thinking about your discussions early in the pandemic and the grind of the last 2 years. And I realized that I'm kind of imagining you crawling over the finish line here this week and getting ready to take a nap. But I don't know. Is that how you feel? Are you tired in your bones now?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question anyone sort of in a role like mine and that's been partnering with so many folks and organizations and city leaders and others, there's no way you can't be somewhat fatigued having dealt with COVID and overcome it in some ways, and then be challenged by the next turn in other ways. And so, you know, I am fatigued, but I wouldn't say that, you know, I'm tired of all the work. What I would say is that obviously the past 4 years in general, but especially the last two, you know, has been blood, sweat, and tears sort of into the work. And I mean that literally, right? I mean, it's been really trying to figure out how to take, you know, especially local government, and make it more nimble, make it move with urgency in times when it struggles to do that, and not to forget the need to come at it from, you know, a truly equitable approach. And so, you know, I think I'm ready to, you know, pass that baton, and obviously well-equipped hands at the Health Commission and well-equipped hands across the city to sort of continue that work. So, yes, I would be lying if I didn't say I'm somewhat fatigued, but I am absolutely proud of the work that we all did to really make our city, you know, strong and get and still be one of the most vaccinated cities in the country, big cities. To me, that's important, and that's no accident. A ton of work went into it, and I'm really proud of that work.
What else are you most proud of? Is that the thing? If you could pick one, I'm just going to have all kinds of these. If you could, questions. If you could pick one thing you are most proud of after the number of years you've served, the number of mayors under whom you've served, right, the number of crises through which you have served, mm-hmm, what are you most personally proud of?
You know, I'm most personally proud of, you know, the resiliency that I got to not only be a part of, help to lead, but also witness through our fight against COVID. You know, we partnered with so many amazing community-based organizations, faith-based organizations, community programs, but also, you know, city workers, workers across multiple departments, across multiple sort of jobs and responsibilities. And we did it at a time when things were tough, right? I mean, every single day, those of us who work in city government say, you know, our work matters and it impacts people's lives. But I think nobody felt that as much as we felt that in 2020 and the work that we needed to do to respond. And so I'm immensely proud of the work we did, you know, under Mayor Walsh's leadership and then Mayor Janey's leadership in 2021. And I'm proud of that work. We did amazing work to engage residents, to, you know, really try to center a response in what was probably one of the most difficult times that this city has ever seen. And there is still more work to do, more progress to be made, but I'm absolutely proud of all the work everyone did and the part that I could play being connected to all of it.
So I want to dive for a minute into the intersection of equity, race, public health, healthcare. Yeah. When you came into the role, that was something, that lack of equity. And we've known for years, the research plays out racial disparities in healthcare, racial disparities in health outcomes, controlling for all kinds of factors. That was something you cared deeply about from the beginning.
Yep.
I noticed in conversations early in the pandemic, you talked about your concern about the disproportionate impact of the pandemic on communities of color. You're talking about it again today, especially when it comes to vaccination. Did you make progress, and what's going to, you know, what got left on the side of the road that you intended to do on that front and you didn't?
Yeah, it's a great question, because I think that the work to tackle health inequities and racial disparities, it is a journey, and it is work that has to continue to be the central focus, I would argue, of the city, not only now, but especially in recovery from what has been, you know, such a difficult time around COVID. I think the city's efforts and the city work with community-based coalitions, with our equity-funded partners, the investments we made to make sure that neighborhoods had the resources to not only, you know, get vaccinated, but before that, get tested, have masks, have the information needed to keep each other safe. Centrally drove our work. I think every week we spent with our health inequities task force sort of focusing on the data, the numbers, the disparities, the gaps, and then creating strategies to address them. And unfortunately, many of those strategies were, you know, what's the operational response today? How do we lift up testing in this neighborhood? How do we lift up, you know, the information that's needed for this community? And how do we make sure we're not leaving people behind in the moment? I think what COVID didn't give us time to be able to do was really look at the system, right? In the moment, we're responding to a crisis and we're operationalizing strategies that were meant to counter those inequities. But unfortunately, when you are in the midst of trying to fight this pandemic, it's hard to dismantle a system that unfortunately has created so many of those inequities. And so that's the work that I wish we could have spent more time on. It's the work that I believe the city must tackle moving forward in partnership with the state to make sure that these longstanding health inequities that made COVID worse for Black and Brown communities have to be a focus of work moving forward. It is hard to do when you're trying to get people booster shots and trying to keep kids safe in schools and trying to keep businesses open and workers working. But again, I do think that's some of the work that I will say we started. It's some of the work that we focused on, but that systemic work is really the work that needs to be the next chapter of this response.
We're talking with Marty Martinez, Chief of Health and Human Services for the City of Boston, whose last day on the job is tomorrow. So I'm listening to you and I hear you. And in that answer, I hear your head. And I think I even hear a little bit of your heart. But I don't feel like I hear your gut yet. Mm-hmm. And I really would love to hear from your gut. Mm-hmm. What have we been getting wrong that you mm-hmm. just really want to see us start to get right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I think for me, you know, the gut tells me that we need to do more to move and respond with urgency on all the inequities that we've experienced, right? So, for example, you know, during COVID, we would look at data from a week and see, listen, we see an increase in infections within the Latino community in East Boston. And so let's pull together the community voices. Let's pull together the providers. Let's figure out, you know, what protective factors we need to strengthen. And then let's spend the next 10 days tackling those. That was time consuming, heavy lifting that was done day in and day out, not just for weeks, but for months and close to a year around COVID and longer. That work hasn't happened around other health inequities. Around other health inequities, we've been planning and we've been implementing programs and services that might, you know, hit a slice of the population. But what we haven't done is say, listen, this is a crisis. We are an emergency and we have to respond that way around these other health inequities that exist. And that's the work we have to do moving forward. COVID forced everybody to think about things like public health and to think about health in general. And we have to take this as an opportunity. And I know it's hard to think of opportunities coming out of COVID, but we have to take this as an opportunity to say, okay, now how do we tackle the other health inequities that sit there? And how do we do that in a way that allows us to move with urgency and be nimble and, to be frank, ways that government doesn't always do. So to me, that's what's in my gut. Yeah. You know, when I walk out the building and go back into Boston, because I'm a Boston resident, so I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to look for the city government to be doing that, while at the same time knowing that crisis response in the moment sometimes prevents you from doing that big picture look. But that's what needs to happen from my viewpoint.
I really appreciate that answer. And I'm going to put you on the spot one more time here, which is, you're leaving the role tomorrow. Did you want to stay? Did you want 4 more years to do that work?
Yeah, no. So I am so proud of the work that I've done. And, you know, obviously there's so much work to be done in health and human services. But no, I was ready to go. This was the time for me to sort of turn the page. As you mentioned, I was brought in by Mayor Walsh, proud of the work. I'm proud to come in and serve him and stayed on to serve Mayor Janey through that transition. But with a new mayor and a new administration and a new 4 years, this was the time for me to sort of thank those who gave me the privilege to be in this role with the city, but also to turn the page as I go back. You know, I'm a nonprofit guy. Most people who know me, I'm a nonprofit guy who happens to have been in city government for the last 4 years. And so this was the time for me to leave. So more work to be done in health and human services, a lot more to do, but it was my time.
So in a minute, I do want to ask you about what's next for you. But before we do that, I want to stay in the space you're in. And I do want to ask you a couple of questions about Mass and Cass.
Sure.
And, you know, it strikes us that most of our listeners have never been there, may never go there, may never see it. Mm-hmm. And what do you say when folks who haven't been there say, why is this so hard to fix? Why can't you just get it done?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's such a challenging area. And if I frame this as, you know, an area that I wish, you know, in my role, or we as a city could have made more systemic progress on, that would be the work around substance use disorder and the impact of that work as we see in Mass and Cass. The issue is complex. And I know it's, some of your listeners' least favorite thing that I say, that it's a complex issue, but it is. It's the intersectionality of people struggling with homelessness and mental health issues and substance use disorder. It's also the example of where the system is broken in many ways. Whether it's the system of getting people, into housing, getting people into the right kinds of treatment.
What's the biggest break? The biggest break in that system?
I think the biggest break in the system is that right now people, especially COVID exacerbated it, but people cannot get the care that they need in the places that they need it. And I don't just mean city or town, but I mean whether they're in a program or a facility, whether they're incarcerated, whether they, are in some sort of agency getting help, but doesn't have the right kinds of resources for individuals. And so people go down a pathway that where they don't get what they need and ultimately end up really at the edge, and I don't know a better way to say it, but people end up at the edge, and the intersectionality of all those issues at Mass and Cass means that the issues are not as simple as, well, let's just put people in a shelter bed. They're not as simple as, let's just get people in detox. Like, they are more complex, and that is why the issues in that neighborhood continue to be a struggle, not only for the city, but continue to be, battling substance use disorder and how it plays on the street. Is an issue for every major city in the country that they're trying to figure out.
Did you fall short in any way? I mean, I know it's a hard question, but I also know you reflect. And it was on your watch. It is complex. It was stymieing. Did you fall short someplace?
There's no question that when you have people in tents, on the street, not getting their needs met, that the system, including the system that I'm a part of and that I help lead, has not been able to deliver what's needed for folks to get them what they need. Does that mean we've fallen short? Absolutely. I would argue the city has fallen short to be able to solve that issue and that crisis. The same is true for our state partners. The same is true for, our public health system. We have not been able to solve that complex issue and get people the care that they need. Having said that, we worked every single day to try to create strategies and solutions that would meet that intersectionality, meet that complexity, and most importantly, remember that people that are on the street are sort of, they are at the edge of struggling with some of the most difficult moments of their lives, and we have to have compassion to approach that issue. And so for me, that's how I've led, but there's no question when people are in the midst of all that, they have been failed. And so that we need to continue to work on it and continue to be part of trying to find solutions. But they are not simple and they will not be solved easily. And anyone who says that doesn't know or understand the complexity of the issue.
So last question for you. You've said you're a nonprofit guy. You've said it's time for the next page. Can you tell us where you're going? Where are we going to see you 6 months from now?
Well, you're going to see me still be a Boston Dorchester resident. That's for sure. I'm not moving or leaving or going anywhere else, but I am going to take a little bit of a break, try to, reset a little bit. I've worked in the nonprofit area in Greater Boston, since late 1990s. And so I'm going to stay invested and committed and, definitely not going anywhere. And my commitment around the issues that I care about around social justice and equity are there. So does it mean nonprofit, doesn't mean government, doesn't mean politics, could mean any of those things. But I'm not going anywhere, so I hope to stay involved.
Marty Martinez, outgoing Chief of Health and Human Services for the City of Boston, really appreciate you reflecting with us.
For sure. Thanks so much.
This summer, as the Taliban took control of Afghanistan and U.S. troops officially left the country, the world watched as thousands of people tried to flee. Here's CNN's Clarissa Ward from the Kabul airport in August.
A crush of people pushing, shoving, screaming, children crying out. I can honestly say it was one of the more harrowing things I have experienced.
A couple of months ago, we here on the show talked to International Institute of New England as they were preparing to welcome hundreds of families from Afghanistan. Well, one of those families, the woman in the family, is Farhanda, and she and her family fled Kabul and settled in New Bedford last month after a three-month odyssey. We're using just her first name here. Her first stop, Qatar, and then
We were in Germany for 35 days. Then from on 14th of October, we came to America. Our first destination was Philadelphia. From Philadelphia, we left for New Jersey. Then again, we were in the airport and we came to Texas. We left Texas and we got on in New Bedford, Boston.
We spoke with her earlier today and we asked her what was it like making the choice to leave Afghanistan.
Our minds were numb. We could not think about anything. The only our concern was our life, our kids' life, our family's life. For the same reason, when we were coming out of the Kabul, so no one was interested in asking, okay, where are we going? But everyone was just thinking, we can go out from here because we are in trouble. Our kids' lives are not safe. We are not safe.
So all the focus was, we just have to get out.
Yes, we just have to get out of this place, the place we loved a lot, and we still love. And our home, our lives, we had everything. Like, I had a good established home. I had a good job. I had my car. I had everything there. My life was quite good there. So I was ready to leave everything behind for nothing and leave the area just for my kids, for my life, for my family life. That was the only thing we were thinking.
Now you're in New Bedford, you, your family, your three kids. Do you feel like you left everything behind for nothing?
Actually, I would say that we are happy we are here. That's something really good. So the thing is, we have to start here from zero. Even I would say, from minus, not zero, from maybe minus.
From less than 10. Zero?
Yes, because we have nothing with us. We are totally blank. Like, we don't have any money. We don't have home. I would like to say something like that. Like, I have a home, but I don't have a home. I have money in bank balance, but I don't have anything, any money, any bank balance. Like, I have a car, but still I don't have a car. So that's something very strange. If I tell this to somebody, he will laugh. Okay, what are you saying?
And you mean because it's all in Afghanistan and not here?
Yes. Yes, in all in Afghanistan, everything is there, but still I don't have anything. I'm here. And so I have to start here. Like, my background is totally blank here.
How are your kids? Are they sleeping? Are they eating? Are they, how are they feeling?
They're feeling happy because the very first thing they were happy for when I got to New Bedford, that was, we have a home. Because for the last 3 months, we were just moving, and we were in tents, we were in camps. Different kind of food. So the very first thing they were so happy for was a home.
Is there anything you are excited about now that you're here?
I'm very much excited about my life, my future, my kids, because as I told you before, we are totally blank here. Will I be able to have a stable life here, a good job here, so I can support my family, I can have a better life the way I had in my own country?
And are you at peace?
Yes, yes. That's what I really want to say. And that when we were in Kabul, we were happy. But the only thing was missing was security for us. But we had learned to live with that. We don't have any concerns about peace here. But we have many other concerns that we didn't have there. So I think life is something, every time you should have a concern about something. Otherwise, that's not life.
That was Farhanda, and we're using only her first name to protect her privacy. She and her family lived in Kabul, Afghanistan, resettled to New Bedford, Massachusetts last month. We spoke with her earlier today. And we turn now to Anka Moraru. She is the managing director of the International Institute of New England's Boston office. In her day-to-day, she helps manage the resettlement of families from Afghanistan, including Farhanda's. Anka, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what's the community that Farhanda is joining? How many people have you helped resettle so far in this wave?
So we received 211 individuals since October 15 in Massachusetts. We've seen more individuals than we hoped to see in such a short period of time. In New Bedford, right now, we only put 4 families. We have a great community in New Bedford, and the community really stepped up, and they are helping the families to settle in New Bedford.
211 seems like a lot of people since October, but this isn't what most of us do for a living. Put that in context for us, 211 compared to, I don't know, last year or last time there was a large group you were resettling. Is it a lot?
Yes, last year we resettled, I think, 30 people in the entire year. So, as you can imagine, it's been taking a toll on our staff, and we are doing our best, but we have arrivals almost every day. We have few families arriving every day. And I think the most challenging part of all of this is housing shortage. So, we just don't have enough apartments to set them up and get them ready for the clients. Some of the families will have to stay in a hotel until we can secure housing.
How does that make you feel to not be able, people who have left, as we heard Farhanda say, everything and come to nothing? And they're, and a 3-month odyssey, and you know, she told me earlier today, they never even knew from one city to the next as they were traveling how long they'd be there or where they were going next. How does it make you feel to not be able to give them some stability in their housing when they get here?
It's terrible, and we are trying so hard, and we just don't know how to do this better. We always reach out to the community and ask if they know anyone who can rent us apartments, who can step up and maybe offer even temporary housing, because that is so important. We don't want to put people in hotels, not even for a night. Of course, it's hard, but there are so many logistical challenges here. We have we receive travel notifications today for an arrival tomorrow. There is no way we can have an apartment ready by tomorrow. So it's very, very challenging. And our staff is doing they're doing their best, and they're terrific.
So Anka, let's step back for a second. So you just received travel notification today for a family that's coming tomorrow. In a normal world, when you receive that travel notification, what would you have to get ready in order for that family to come? And how long would it take to do that?
So the first thing is to find an apartment, rent the apartment, then furnish the apartment. We either get donated furniture or we buy furniture. And obviously, if we buy beds, it's going to take a few days for the beds to be delivered. We need to set up the apartment, as I said, and make sure that it becomes a home. And by grocery shopping, provide everything that is to be provided for a family to feel welcomed. And obviously, in a day or even 2 days, we just don't have the time to do that.
How many days does it take? Is it 2 weeks? Is it a month?
Yes, it is at least 2 weeks. And usually when we resettle refugees, we usually get between 2 to 3 weeks advance notice when we receive a travel notification. But right now, we just don't have that. We just don't have that, unfortunately.
So I heard you say earlier, you were saying, you know, we reach out to people. We ask them, do you know anybody who's got an apartment that they can rent, et cetera. I've done some work in this space in the past, and I know that rallying communities, having communities offer their resources, their support, having those volunteers be part of the solution can make a huge difference. Are our communities here in Massachusetts stepping up? And if they are, how? And if they aren't, what do you need them to do to step up?
We did receive an incredible community support. We have volunteers who are ready to set up apartments, to do airport reception, providing food, actually cooking and providing food for our clients, doing grocery shopping with our clients, and not to mention many, many, many donations. I think housing is just hard in general to find. We do have people who are offering homestays for our clients, but we have some large families who it's kind of impossible to put in a homestay, so we would need apartments. So I think the most important thing for us, if anyone listens and is a landlord and or has some property, please reach out to us. We are helping these people to put their life together, and we will welcome any help.
Do you want to tell us your website? And we will have it on radioboston.org
yes,
as well.
Yes, our website is iine.org, and you can find all the information there. You can reach out personally to me if you have anything available or you know of anyone who is willing to rent.
And in the meantime, for those families in hotel rooms, are there things that community members can do to make them feel more at home? Are there donations that you need? You mentioned people cooking and serving meals, offering supplies. What else can Massachusetts families do to rally around our new neighbors?
I think for the families in the hotel, just visiting them. I think that some obviously will have to organize and coordinate some visits, but I think we want to make sure that our families feel welcomed. Even if they are in a hotel, they know that people are there for them and they are welcome in their new environment.
And how many more families are you anticipating? You've said 211 so individuals so far. Do you know how many more are coming?
Yes. So in Massachusetts, we already welcomed 211, and we are expecting a total of 425 by February.
That is breathtaking, given that last year I hear your laughter. I guess I want to ask you, I mean, you're sounding so sane, right? In the middle of this important onslaught, how are you keeping everybody going? Where's the peace and joy coming from? Because I know that's important to then reflect on those who are experiencing disruptions we can't even begin to imagine for their families.
I think the most important thing is to think what's going to happen in 3 months from now, right? Like, where are these people going to be in 3 months from now? And thinking that in 3 months they will be in a welcoming home. And some of them will already have jobs, and they will be able to, the kids will be enrolled in school, and they will be able to put their life together. I think that's what we strive to make sure we are looking for that light at the end of the tunnel. And we know it's there. It's just going to be a really hard period of time until February when everybody's traveling. But I think we'll get through it, and then we'll help every single family become self-sufficient and feel like U.S. is home and Massachusetts is home.
So, Anca, and we're on a hard clock, so really a one-sentence answer here. Everybody here by February, when do you think they're settled?
Well, I think some of the families who already are in their apartments, they are starting to be settled. We already have clients who are already employed. So, and right now we have all the children going through immunizations to make sure that they are enrolled in school. So I would think that from the date of arrival, it only takes a couple of months to really settle.
Anca, thank you so much. Anca Moraru, the Managing Director of the International Institute of New England's Boston office. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Finally today, we want to take you to WBUR's City Space, where earlier this week, I spoke with Huma Abedin, a longtime aide to Hillary Clinton. She was in town to talk about her new memoir, Both And, A Life in Many Worlds. Her life story is complex, born in the U.S., but a cloistered childhood spent in Saudi Arabia, to the inner circle of the Clinton White House, and then Hillary Clinton's campaigns, to her tumultuous, very public and humiliating relationship with former Democratic representative from New York and former husband, Anthony Weiner. And just a warning, this discussion touches on subjects that might not be appropriate for all listeners. Weiner, you'll remember, resigned from Congress in 2011 after having sent a sexually suggestive photo to a woman and was later sentenced to 21 months in prison for an unrelated charge of sexting obscene material to a minor. Caught in the middle of the firestorm, his then-wife, Huma Abedin. And she told me that her memoir is a chronicle of her journey to reclaim her own personal narrative.
Maybe I did want to take back my history that clearly somebody else is writing. And if you think that you can summarize my history as one word and that scandal, that is unacceptable to me. And so this is me taking ownership.
We dove deep into the collision of her personal and professional lives and the lessons she can offer us all to anyone struggling with hardship. Here's just a sample of our conversation, although you can find the full hour at radioboston.org. And we will begin with the personal and her connection to Anthony Weiner.
Anthony was my first love. He was the first man I was ever with. I mean, I opened the chapter with waking up at Buckingham Palace. I lived this dream life. It was extraordinary. And so to all of a sudden have this shock to my system, and then the years of, as I write in the book, asking over and over again, why? Why is this happening? And not understanding it, really writing it. You know, I had to do the hardest thing because I went to a very low place. Because I think a lot of people who are in situations similar to me, you feel judged by your family and your community sometimes. You don't know what the right choice is. And for me, I opened the book with a letter from my father. I found it after he died, just in his diary. And it says, you know, let others do what you will. You are responsible in the first instance to yourself, your principles and values, and to your God. And everything else is, you know, it'll sort itself out.
So I want to put a little bit of material up here. No matter how hard I tried, whether it was to help Anthony, to threaten him, to sympathize him, to ignore him, to throw him out of my house, it was impossible to move on. This man was going to ruin me. Now he was going to jeopardize HRC's chances of winning the presidency. And then later, Anthony, I said, wanting to shake him through the phone, if she loses this election, it will be because of you and me. That night, I wrote one line in my notebook: I do not know how I'm going to survive this. Help me, God. We have an audience question that says, you've gone through so much, and I think this underscores that. Why would you even consider blaming yourself for HRC election loss or James Comey?
So I shared moments as I was going through them in real time. And in that moment, I mean, it was such a shock. It was such a came out of nowhere. It was so unprecedented. I did carry that responsibility, that sense of guilt, for a long time after the election. It's hard not to.
And I'm sorry, I should give some context for those who don't know. Close to the election date.
11 days before.
Right. Well, you can do it. It's your story.
Well, 11 days before. So at the beginning of the campaign, right when Hillary announced she was running for president in 2015, the FBI announced that they were launching an investigation into her use of emails, not using State Department emails, and that which other people had done before and other people would do after, but they were investigating her, and it turned out to be a year-long investigation. The investigation concluded in the summer of 2016, and then 11 days before the election, the FBI announced, sent a letter to Congress essentially saying that they had found some emails between me and Hillary on a laptop of Anthony's that had been confiscated by the U.S. attorney in New York. It's complicated. That they were reopening the investigation. And it was big news. And usually you don't make big news like this so close to an election so that it doesn't sway the election. And they were also investigating the other campaign, just FYI, did not say anything public about that. And then 2 days before the election, a second announcement comes and says that, and the announcement was essentially, the investigation's closed again, we've looked at everything, and there's nothing to see there. And what was so shocking is that if they had called us, I mean, we were cooperating, obviously, in this investigation for the full year, we would have said, look at everything, see, you know, take a look at whatever you want. So it was a real shock, it was a real surprise. And in an election that was so close, with every little thing mattering, every little thing mattered, this was a huge, huge thing, and it caused an earthquake.
So, and I'm making a conscious choice on this one because that's something that we could dive a lot more into. And I'm mindful of how much time we have here. And I think there are those who would love to dive more into that. But that's been dove into a million times. And there's other parts of this story that have less so, that have to do with being a woman, being a wife, forging your way ahead after a pretty profound betrayal. I mean, Anthony was being investigated at that time for, as I understand it, the crime that he eventually pled guilty to, having to do with an exchange with a girl who was not yet a woman. And what strikes me in all of that, and wanting to talk to you about that, is I want to know how responsible, how accountable a woman should be held for something her husband does. And I'm interested, as someone who's had to live through that, we've seen so many women over the years who are in public leadership, whose husbands, including the one you worked for, have done something and it spills into their lives. It spills into their world. It spills into their professional experiences. And there is a pattern there. And as a woman who's lived through it, I'm so interested in how you think about that. And do we get that right?
Well, I'm not sure I'm the right person to ask because I don't think it's okay. And I am the person who was on the other end of it. And I share the stories in the book about being disinvited from parties, about being asked not to show up at charities, about being the woman with a scarlet letter on her chest. So yes, I have lived in that space and place, and it is not fun. And it got to a point where I was done with it. I recount that story in the book where I couldn't even take my son swimming in the same, you know, pool with his father without a woman coming to me and saying, shame on you, and shaking her finger. And we do this as a society. We do this, and it's men and women. I'm not sure I'm the most qualified person because I've been on the other side of it, but...
Doesn't that make you the most qualified person?
I was raised to have a sense of radical empathy for other people. That is how my parents raised me, which is if there is somebody who is the other, you go into those conversations. You don't shy away from not trying to understand what the other person's perspective is, what they're feeling, and what they're going through. And then I came into a work environment where I was surrounded by that also. And so for me, sure, I can say it's not all right and you can't treat people that way. But we tend to, number one, I think in my 30s, up until my 30s rather, you care a lot, especially as women. I think you care a lot about how other people judge you and perceive you. And, you know, the slights are horrific. I mean, they do something to you. They really do something inside your sense of self-worth and self-confidence. You know, being prepared to walk into a room and being asked to leave, it's not something that one can prepare for or that ever becomes okay. But to me, I try to look at how you prevent these cycles from passing on to the next generation. It is one of the reasons why, you know, I wasn't even 12 weeks pregnant when the scandal with, you know, Anthony broke, and you just described some of his behavior, and I didn't understand it for a very long time. And even now on the book tour, as I talk to people, there are several people, both men and women, who will say to me, I just don't understand. And what I say to everybody I have these conversations with is I used to be you. And frankly, I'm jealous of you because if you are somebody who does not have a spouse, a partner, a child, a parent, a sibling, or a loved one who is dealing with addiction or mental health challenges or some sort of compulsive behavior, then you don't understand. And I had to really go to the hardest, lowest place. And it was work I had to do with Anthony to understand that when people are in the throes of addictive behavior, they do all kinds of things that normally they would never even consider. And so I had to do the work. I had to respect the process. And it's a really hard process. I had to learn that people went through a lot harder things than I've gone through. And people will read the book and think that's, you know, hard, but there are. I mean, I was constantly conscious. I am constantly conscious of the privilege I have. I mean, I think about my father. I took my son back in 2018. In 2018, I took my son home to Saudi Arabia and finally to pack up my father's closet. It's close. My mother's house. Our house in Saudi Arabia is Miss Abisham's house. My mother doesn't throw out anything. I go into his closet, and as I started taking out his clothes to give them away, I noticed that on all of his undershirts, there was blood. And it was because he'd had his kidney transplant. And for years, he'd had so many procedures and the dialysis and needles. And I think of what I saw in my dad every single day. He was smiling. He was perfectly dressed. And frankly, I feel as though that was his final lesson to me 26 years later, which is there can be hope and joy despite the pain. You just had to have that approach to the world. And that is the approach I have to the world. As to how society, I changed the way society treats women who've been in positions like me, I don't think I can single-handedly do it, but I can definitively say it is not okay. And we have done it for a long time and we continue to do it. And I write in the book, just putting, you know, aside my situation, is how hard it is for women in the public space to be seen, taken seriously, and as leaders and certainly as executives. Forget commander-in-chief.
So I'm having this picture as you're writing that part, and I'm like, I'm picturing the sweater that you're going to save for Jordan from your father, but then you find blood on everything, right? Was there anything you were able to keep that you'll be able to give your son?
Yes. Well, we kept his pipes. My dad was a big pipe smoker, so all the grandchildren get a pipe, and we kept...
I did not see that coming.
Oh, yeah. And we had some scarves. It was really just his undershirts, but, you know, we kept his scarves and sweaters. We've kept little things. But, you know, my father was not about hoarding. He was exactly the opposite. He had two pairs of ballet shoes, black and brown, and he wore them out. You know, he believed that we should, you know, you should own only what you needed, you know, good quality, and when you were done using, you should give it away and replace it with one pair. And so... his closet was immaculate, and he left this really pristine legacy, and it's one of the reasons why I try to share a lot about him in the book.
So two last questions, one from an audience member and one from me. So from the audience member, what advice do you have for those who are struggling after difficult experiences or trying to move forward after a loss?
Well, I always, for myself, and what I like to share when people ask me is, I think it's okay to not be okay. And I think for a long time, I kept so much anger and bitterness kind of locked up inside. I didn't understand. And I didn't acknowledge that I wasn't okay. And it wasn't until I had a chapter that was called Letting Go, and I think it's now called Truth Hurts, but it's okay to let go of some of the hurt, the anger, the guilt, but to allow yourself to feel, because walling yourself off from the feeling, at least for me, It did not work, but to experience the emotions and working through them and hopefully coming out on the other side, I certainly have been lucky enough to do that. It's worth putting in the work.
And so my last question for you, when I finished the book, I thought, okay, what's your love story? Who's your love story?
Well, his name is Jordan Zane. He is the young man who woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning and said, "Mommy, where are you going?" And I said, "I'm going to Boston." And, you know, I just cannot, and it's something you just, you know, it's why I write the story about the whole experience of this child who kind of fell out of me. Like, God, I share this. I haven't actually talked about this at all in any single interview, but my pregnancy was easy. I got pregnant totally by accident, carried this child. He basically fell out of me. I was so blessed, so, so blessed. And I just think that he is my gift from God. It's whatever hardships you're going to have or I have put on you, I'm giving you this gift. And I have that gift. I'm so grateful to have that gift.
And when you talk with him 20 years from now about these days in your life, what's the story you tell?
That to have principles and values is an important thing. To know that you are loved, that you are cherished, that you are supported no matter what you do. And I hope Jordan, when he's old enough, will read this book and come away feeling very proud of his mommy and also come away with a feeling of gratitude that, "Mommy, thank you for helping trying to help my daddy too." I think that's important. I think, you know, the only way we try to understand some of this behavior in adult men is really not to, you know, I am trying to raise a son who grows up to respect women and not fear their power. And I think that's the only way we change how society treats women leaders.
Huma Abedin, longtime aide to Hillary Clinton, speaking with me at WBUR's City Space this week about her new memoir, Both And, A Life in Many Worlds. You can find a link to the full conversation at our website, radioboston.org.